From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, stories of Mom for Mother's Day.
He asked me, "What do you want for Mother's Day, Mom?" I look into his eyes, which are just as sad as mine, and know he understands because his sorrow goes as deep. When I say, "I always cry on Mother's Day."
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On this Mother's Day weekend, we honor our life givers, our moms. But that mother-offspring relationship is frequently complicated and always intense. We're going to hear five true stories about mothers and mothering written by a group of San Antonio women writers called The Next Chapter. And as these women share their stories, discovering the beauty and power of their own words, we encourage others to find their voices and write your personal story. There's no greater heirloom to leave to your future generations. Today we're going to hear stories about motherhood written and read by Janie Alonzo, Belza Elia Ramos, Virginia Valenzuela, Lupe Gonzalez, and Mary Olivia Putino.
This is Janie Alonzo, and my story is Pomegranates. Without a word, Mom sat me on an old wooden chair in the backyard of our house in San Antonio, Texas. Her black sewing scissors came out of her red cotton apron. Tras, tras, went the scissors. My long, flowing brown hair fell like dead leaves on the packed earth. Bitter tears tumbled freely from my eyes. She didn't know I wanted to have my hair long, just like the pictures of my cousins. Their black and white photographs showcased long, beautiful, flowing hair, draping down like rolling waves of bronze wheat. They looked like the Breck shampoo girls. Why couldn't I have my hair long and be beautiful? Wearily, Mom said, "Tenemos mucho trabajo. No hay tiempo para lágrimas." She had too much work, packing clothes, preparing food for the annual summer trip to Musquis, Mexico. There was no time for tears. We stayed at my abuelita Virginia's house and ate our meals at Tia Chita's enormous house. Tia's casa had a large kitchen and dining table. The floors were green painted cement, and she poured water on them every morning and evening. This made the house cool in the summer. Close by was the water well, La Noria, where we drew all our drinking, cooking, cleaning, and bathing water from the long, deep hole. Tia Chita was a tall, plump, beautiful woman with high cheekbones. She always wore gold half-moon earrings like the Mexican movie stars, like Maria Felix or Maria Victoria. Her long hair was braided and wrapped round and round into a bun. Before she stooped down to kiss us, her large, soft hands would caress our faces. Con mucho cariño. I wanted to look like her. Gently, she announced, "Niños, vamos a comer." Pulling the aguacates directly from the avocado trees, we ate at the table until our pancitas were full. Orange and lemon trees were not off limits, and we ate the fruit or plucked lemons for delicious lemonade. Fig trees were plentiful, and we carefully washed and peeled them because their milky sap, it caused itching or stinging. Towards the back of the house was another tree I had never noticed. As Tia and Mom were peeling oranges, I asked what kind of tree was in the back. Tia Chita said, "Son granadas y se comen con mucho cuidado." Granadas, pomegranates, were new to me. Mom gave me a stern look and pointed her finger at me. "Vale más que no te manches con esas granadas." Tia looked at me with soft brown eyes and defended me. "No la regañes, Victoria. Para eso son las granadas, pa' que gocen." If I got dirty, it was one more piece of clothing Mom would have to scrub on the washboard, the tallador. To her, I was a machetona, the tomboy who couldn't keep her clothes clean or dirt under her nails. I played softball, football, kickball with all the boys. She had cut my hair short, not to make a fashion statement, but to prevent more work for her, combing and braiding hair. "I will show you." I walked away, determined to get my hands on those granadas. Yanking one off the tree, I walked back to the table. Mom had already laid out newspaper. She put a full apron over me and demonstrated how to open my first pomegranate. Not wanting me to get dirty, she said, "Ten cuidado con la cáscara. Eso es lo que mancha." I had to be careful with the skin as it would stain clothes. The pomegranate was round and ruby-colored, with a tip at the end like the hat Jughead from the Archie comics used to wear. She peeled it carefully and squeezed it between her hands. It split in two. Inside were red seeds like see-through popcorn kernels. I ate the first seed and it squirted inside my mouth. It tasted sweet. No te las comas todavía. Mom said to wait. It was better to make a pile and eat each kernel slowly. It took me a half hour to clean and peel the fruit. I gathered up my ruby-colored jewels and ate them one by one. They were so good, so cool, so pretty in my hand. I wondered, why does something sweet inside have to be so bitter outside?
I am Belsa Elia Ramos, and the title of my story is Unexpected Glimpses of My Mother's Youth. When I finally admitted that my parents were old, I started interviewing them and my older siblings to write our family story. My parents and brothers' usual response was, Ay, deja el pasado en el pasado, y los muertos muertos. They wanted to forget the past and would not talk about people who were long dead. As the youngest of 12, with only six of us surviving to adulthood, there was 19 years difference between my oldest sister Carmen and me. Everyone was out of the home by the time I was 3. With their code of silence, information for my story would be limited to documents and casual reminiscing by others. My mother did admit once, yo me crié como la Cenicienta. Her older half-brother and spinster half-sister, Marcos and Cecilia, raised her, but expected her to earn her keep, like Cinderella. Mama Panchita and Toto, Antonio, eked a living from La Porción 59, a Spanish land grant, and being migrant workers part of the year. Life without running water and electricity was hard. Mama worked from dusk to dawn in the fields, and then at home canning, baking, and sewing for the family and others. She was very artistic, raffling off her quilts, hand-knit doilies, tablecloths, and other creations to raise money for San Jose Church in Salineño, Texas. Her father had donated land and materials for it and for the cemetery. She taught every child in the village the catechism for First Communion and confirmation. She was also the one to call for home remedies and prayer when someone got sick or was dying. The one to get people out to vote, to teach young men to read and write so they could get into the army. In 1955, my brothers moved us to Corpus Christi, Texas. Here there would be better schools and colleges for me and doctors for our parents. Shortly after, Mama was diagnosed with diabetes. By following her diet meticulously, she remained healthy for many years. In the Hispanic Catholic culture of South Texas, as the youngest, I was to take care of my parents in their old age. But Mama and Toto, who had recovered from a stroke, were still self-sufficient at 75 and 81 years of age. Inevitably, my mother suffered liver complications from a diabetes medicine, then fell and broke her leg, triggering her downfall. She became a fragile diabetic and showed signs of dementia. My two brothers and I took turns sleeping over with her and Toto. They had caregivers during the day. It was hectic taking care of two households, 13 miles apart, and teenage kids and working. Yet, for 3 years, I would not agree to put Mama in a nursing home. Going home to get ready for work and the kids to school after a sleepless night of caregiving, I had a freak accident. This incident worried me. My children would be alone if anything happened to me. I finally gave in, and in 1987, we put Mama in a nursing home. Toto, still lucid and strong, checked himself in soon after to be close to his bride of over 65 years. Sadly, as her dementia advanced, she did not recognize visitors and often regressed into the past. Some days she would be a child, others a young mother. My brothers and I had a running argument about dealing with this. They tried to bring her back to reality, whereas I went along with her reality. ¿Cómo estás, mamita? ¿Quién eres tú? Belsa, mamita. On good days, she would be Belsita, But on bad days, she would say, I have a daughter named Belsa, or mucho gusto, as if meeting me for the very first time. But now I was getting glimpses of her youth. One day she was sobbing, ¿Dónde están mi papá y mi mamá? Hace mucho que no los veo. She now was a young child missing her parents. No doubt she felt abandoned. Her father, who had spent half his time in Mexico, died there when she was six. After he died, her mother, Mama Merced, who had been only 19 to his 60 years of age when they had my mother and her sister, was treated as a servant by her adult stepchildren. Fed up, she left, leaving my mother, but taking her younger daughter. Only the muertos know the reason for this. I needed to console the child in my mom. I said her father had written instructing Marcos to get a tutor for her and take good care of her. He loves you and wants you to get educated. And Mama Merce will be so proud when you learn to read and write. She calmed down. Another day she said, Carmelita ya tiene 3 años y no camina. A heavy sugar sack had fallen on my oldest sister Carmen as a baby, weakening her legs. Mama tried a home remedy. She rubbed turtle blood on Carmen's knees and lower back. Mamita, you cured Carmen. You should see her dancing now. As she beamed with happiness, she asked, ¿Y cómo sabe usted eso? How would a stranger know this? Later, she told me about the pretty dress, bonnet, and pantaloons that Cecilia had sewn for the wedding tomorrow. She wanted to wear them to bed tonight. Cecilia said no, because they would get wrinkled. Vas a ser la más linda de todas las niñas mañana. At another visit, she greeted me sadly. Antonio has another woman. I rushed to the activity room to get my father. Hug her and tell her you love her. Doña Francisca, ¿sabe usted cuánto la quiero? This was his usual term of endearment, at which Mama would always tease back. Pues quién sabe, Don Antonio. Now she blushed. Pues quién sabe, Don Antonio. This was a good day.
My name is Virginia Valenzuela. My story is, qué lástima. Like a wave slowly gaining strength from the very deepest part of the ocean, and without warning, crashing through every crevice in my body, that's how each contraction felt. In active labor, I could think of nothing more than when the next wave would come hurtling through, while tightly gripping the sides of the bed in unwelcome anticipation. There were brief shifts of stillness and calm when I attempted to recall the excitement a new baby would bring, especially to the two big sisters waiting at home. There was also the element of surprise, not knowing whether this would be the one, the male child. Long before ultrasounds were the norm for pregnant women to determine the gender of their unborn babies, we often depended on Aunt Mary or Abuelita Casimira to give us the much anticipated verdict. Unlike the scientific methods of today, Aunt Mary would thread a needle and hold on to the end of the thread. Steadying her hand, she would allow the needle to swing over the woman's stomach until it stopped on its own. If the needle moved back and forth, it was to be female. Or if it moved side to side, the verdict was a male. That needle seemed to move magically as we watched with great anticipation. The shape of the woman's stomach was another indicator. If it was very smooth and round, it was predicted to be a girl, while if the tummy protruded in an edgy, pointy fashion, it would most definitely be a boy. Now, this technique did not necessarily apply just to human subjects. It also helped determine the gender of Mom's parrot, when we could not decide whether to name it Panchita or Panchito. The swinging needle worked its magic, and Panchita joined the ranks of all the other females in the family. The swinging needle episode was never a quiet, solemn affair. In many Mexican-American South Texas traditions, it was a ritual, with all the women gathered around the mother-to-be, laughing and telling stories of their own birthing experiences. Once the prediction was made, there were shouts of, ¡Ay, pobrecita! If it was to be female, or ¡Era tiempo! If it was determined to be male. Such was the case particularly in a family with a predominance of females. The women knew only too well and often shared their stories of what a difficult life it was for mujeres. Men were treated differently. Los reyes del hogar. It was, after all, a man's world. This was not a time to think about life's difficulties, but a time to celebrate the life that was to be. What was amazing was that after the child was born, Aunt Mary would declare, Ves, te lo dije. But since there was never any written documentation of the predictions, and no one ever argued with Aunt Mary, we were all happy to marvel at her astonishing accuracy and gushed over the newborn. In the case of my third pregnancy, after having given birth to two beautiful and healthy daughters, I decided to forego the family tradition of a swinging needle or being prodded and paraded around to judge the contour of my stomach. Much to the disappointment of my tías and primas, we would all be surprised at the same time. While I prayed for a healthy child, it would not be completely honest to say I didn't wish for a son, if only to appease my mother-in-law, who often chided me for not giving her favorite son a male heir. Clearly, producing un hijo paved the way to worthiness. After all, my sister-in-law had given birth to 7 daughters, yet only after her son was born was there a sense that her family was finally complete. Had I known then that a child's gender is determined by the father, I would have had some ammunition. But instead, guiltily accepting the blame, I would just smile and nod, agreeing to some of the home remedies she suggested for assuring my next pregnancy would produce a son. Ay, qué tonta. On May 7, 1975, I received the ultimate Mother's Day gift. I gave birth to a beautiful baby girl. Her dark brown eyes sparkled brightly, and her head full of jet black hair stood so straight that no comb, brush, or dippity-doo could calm. She won my heart as I held her for the first time and checked out all her fingers and toes, making sure they were all accounted for. Nothing could have diminished my delight as I held on to this newborn miracle. Thoughts of ever wanting to give birth to a son were long forgotten. When the phone in my hospital room rang, I immediately recognized the voice at the other end. It was my mother-in-law. 35 years later, I still recall the sting in her voice as the words tumbled out flawlessly. Pues, qué lástima que fue mujer. I remember clearly how my heart pounded so hard I thought it would thump right out of my chest. My baby was only a few hours into this world. My head and body were still groggy from the anesthesia. Had I heard her correctly? Had she uttered, "What a pity it was a girl"? I could not possibly respond. There were no words. I felt nauseous. How could I respond to this incredulous statement? What came over me immediately was an overwhelming feeling to protect my newborn and the determination that she would not fall prey to this type of maligning, outrageous attitude. Almost as though this newborn daughter of mine had heard and understood the meaning of those words her grandmother uttered at her birth, she proved from the very beginning it was no prediction for what was to come. This daughter, who is not only beautiful and intelligent, has demonstrated over and over her absolute determination and outright audacity by becoming a young woman who is gracious and loving. And each day I thank God and say with such pride, qué orgullo que fue mujer.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. Today we're listening to stories about motherhood on this Mother's Day weekend. Let's get back to the stories.
I'm Lupe Gonzalez, and my story is I Always Cry on Mother's Day. I always cry on Mother's Day, Mommy said, and continued knitting the dough for tortillas. Why? I asked, not knowing what to say. I looked around the comfortable kitchen, the green and yellow print curtains blowing in the warm West Texas breeze, the aluminum table where Mommy worked, and the yellow linoleum floor. I didn't have my mother. She died when I was 2, Mommy answered, and blinked her eyes rapidly, something I knew she did when she tried to keep tears from coming. She began to roll out the first tortilla. How can I miss her? I never even knew her. It's silly. Not really understanding her, I said, I'm sorry, Mommy. Can I have the first tortilla? You know you'll go crazy if you eat the first one, she admonished me. I didn't really believe the old wives' tale or superstition. Somehow I knew she told my sisters and me that so she could prolong the anticipation for us. We had to wait for the second tortilla before we could butter it and taste that first delicious dripping bite. As I watched Mommy roll out the dough, I wondered at her reaction. All I'd asked her was what she wanted for Mother's Day. I was at the end of my semester at community college. After this month, I would be leaving home for the first time to attend a nearby university for 2 years to obtain my bachelor's degree. I was a college girl looking toward the future. 6 years later, Mommy passed away. By then, I was married and had a 3-year-old son. On the first Mother's Day without her, We remembered her by going to the cemetery to place red roses, her favorite, in her vase. I stood looking down at the recently broken ground. No grass yet. The headstone depicted a rosary stretched out across the top. One of Mommy's lessons had been to pray, always pray, especially the rosary. Before I left, I said, "Mommy, I had you in my life for 26 years, such a short time, and I'm not ready." My heart bled for the loss of Mommy. I couldn't understand what happened. She had been admitted to the hospital for an appendectomy. Complications arose, the doctor said. However, they couldn't give us details. So I went on with my life as best I could without my mother. I tried to remember how she'd taken care of us, how gentle and loving she'd been even when she disciplined us, and how she'd put her daughter's well-being above all else. I tried to do the same in raising my son. 5 years later, my youngest son was born. We all felt joy return to our family. My oldest son was thrilled to have a little brother. Even though I felt fear because I was now a single mom with two little boys, I was happy and hopeful. Many years followed with my sons growing up, getting into trouble, as children are prone to do, and challenging my love and authority. My mother's words continued to ring in my ears. Be gentle, be loving, be patient, always pray. When my youngest son was diagnosed with leukemia when he was 15, I turned to prayer. I recited the rosary day and night, sitting by my son's bedside. But he did not survive. Now my oldest son and I sit in his truck at Georgia's Drive-In and eat hamburgers, something we won't be able to do once the weather gets so hot and humid in South Texas that we'll hardly be able to stand it. He asks me, "What do you want for Mother's Day, Mom?" I look into his eyes, which are just as sad as mine, and know he understands because his sorrow goes as deep, when I say, "I always cry on Mother's Day."
My name is Mary Olivia Patiño, and the title of my story is El Delantar, The Apron, A Memory of Mother to Share. Not too long ago, my grandson Brennan was working on a school project based on genealogy and family history. When I found out his teacher asked the students to include artifacts, my first reaction was to laugh. I wasn't that old, I thought, to have artifacts. However, as I pondered the project, I knew that I had to dig, to search. I gathered what little artifacts or mementos I had. As I looked through my linen closet, my eyes fell upon an orange striped apron. Suddenly, I knew that I had a treasured artifact to pass on to my grandson, with a story about his abuelita Elvira, my mother. But first, let me explain how I feel about aprons. In Spanish, we call aprons delantares. Delantares, or to come before. The meaning of the word is somewhere in there. Aprons have always fascinated me. Aprons of all styles and colors, with wide pockets, wide waistbands, flared skirts, and pinafore aprons attract me. Speaking of aprons reminds me that my first sewing project in junior high home economics was an apron. I found an olive green fabric, and alongside other girls, I sewed my first apron. How proud I was. As I look back on my first accomplishment as a seamstress, I realized that aprons were important for me because they symbolized something more significant than fashions or colors. Aprons bring beautiful memories of my mother. You see, for most of her life, my mother worked as a waitress. She worked at several restaurants in San Antonio, Frankie's Cafe, the Golden Star, Mi Tierra, and Casa Rio. Once, when I asked her how she came to work as a waitress, dijo, "Pues era el único trabajo que pude encontrar, ya que no sabía hablar inglés." I learned that while doing migrant work in South Texas, she had also worked as a waitress in Falfurrias before coming to San Antonio in search of work. She did not know English, but little by little, she learned a few words and phrases. I still recall her standing at the ironing board, pressing a clean apron. My sisters and I also took turns ironing her aprons. I remember it was particularly difficult to iron the pockets. I was so careful not to leave wrinkles on the pockets. It was like a ritual for me. First, iron the skirt part of the apron, next the pockets, then the waistband, then the ties at the very last. Thinking of it now, pockets were important too, because they held her tips, our livelihood. So now, as I held the orange striped apron, I visualized my mother getting ready for work at Casa Rio restaurant. She draped the apron over her arm and opened the door, saying goodbye y pórtense bien. We had her command to behave. Walking a distance to the bus stop, she rode into town, got off, and started a long shift. Once in a while, we got to see Mother working at Casa Rio. As a child, the comings and goings of the waiters and waitresses carrying their huge trays on one arm, plates laden with cheese enchiladas, ranchero beans, and sizzling fajitas fascinated me. How could they carry so many plates on one tray? Paper flowers and strings of lights with vibrant colors lent fiesta excitement to the air. Casa Rio is still a popular Mexican restaurant along the San Antonio River. Tourists dine indoors or outside on patio tables, accompanied by bright ornaments and mariachis, while watching colorful boats glide by. I remember one Mother's Day as she prepared for work. She proudly pinned the Mother's Day corsage that we'd given her for this special day. She worked on most holidays, and Mother's Day was no different. About 3 years ago, Mother started giving out some of her possessions. Here, she told me, opening her dining cabinet, Toma, agarra lo que quieras. Take whatever you want. Somewhat timidly, I selected a few white kitchen linens with embroidered Mexican motifs. I had always loved these, which frequently covered her freshly cooked tortillas. Then I saw an apron. It was striped in orange. Casa Rio, dare I ask for it? She saw me eyeing the apron and said, Sí, llévatelo, as she handed it to me. Now, as I remember my mother's hard work and how she always placed us as her number one priority, providing for us and giving us an education, I knew that this orange apron symbolized so much. But mostly, it stood for my mother's love for us. Another memory strikes at my heart. My mother is standing before the stove, wearing an apron, brewing coffee in a clay pot. I don't know how it happened, but somehow, as she lifted the pot from the burner, it shattered. Boiling coffee fell on her legs, burning her badly. She fell and broke one of her legs, putting her in a cast for a long time. I remember the ugly purple burns. I don't think I knew then what she had sacrificed. But I learned to be extremely careful, because accidents happen when we least expect them. But most of the memories of my mother's aprons are nostalgic. Now it was time to pass this apron on, along with the story from my grandson about his abuelita Elvira. I mailed the apron with other artifacts and the booklet of stories to Brennan in Vancouver, Washington. Mom, I will return the apron and other items after the project is complete and exhibited, my daughter Catherine said. Keep it, I told her. Just take care of it. Treasure it. I think the apron meant a lot to my grandson and daughter, too. You see, my daughter worked as a waitress to place herself through college before she received her fellowship. Today, she, her husband, and my two grandsons have a bakery. Each wears an apron every day when baking.
We have been celebrating Mother's Day by listening to stories about motherhood written and read by the San Antonio group, The Next Chapter. And that's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can comment directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.